You probably heard it said before that about two-thirds of Americans die in hospitals or nursing homes or some institution, which is pretty much the last place anybody really wants to die. When we allow ourselves to think about death, it's often a thought of dying at home in our own beds with family nearby. Today's guest wanted something like that for her grandmother, her Bubby. Deborah Zaslow took Bubby in at the age of 103 after she'd already spent a while in a nursing home. The tale is told in Deborah Zaslow's book, Bringing Bubby Home. Deborah Gordon Zaslow teaches storytelling and writing, including memoir writing, both at Southern Oregon University and at workshops across the country. If the last name sounds familiar, she's married to Rabbi David Zaslow, who joined us a year ago to talk about his book on Jesus. So quite a productive writing family. Good to have you here, Deborah.
Thanks for having me.
There are a couple of events you list right in quick succession at the beginning of Bringing Bubby Home. The death of a parakeet and David visiting Bubby. Can you talk about the interconnection between those?
Well, you know, The memoir, Bringing Bubby Home, a memoir of letting go through love and death. Obviously, love and death are the themes here. And the book evolved from a journal that I kept. And the morning that I started the journal was the morning that we decided to bring, or maybe it was the day before, to bring my grandmother home. And that was the day that the parakeet died. So I started out that way, and it seemed like I kept it because it seemed like an apropos way to introduce the subject of life and death in our home, right in the middle of our family. So, and as far as David's visit to her, my grandma had lived alone till she was 101.
Wow.
She was amazingly mentally alert and physically okay, but then a fall landed her in the hospital, and then she got put in a nursing home against her will. And so she really deteriorated in that nursing home, and I had visited her a couple of times. That was in Los Angeles. And could see how her mental faculties were, everything was deteriorating, and she was very alone there. There was really nobody to visit her. She'd outlived three of her five children, one of whom was my mother. So her oldest daughter was the only one who lived in the area. She was 85 and she didn't drive. So no, she was just rotting alone there, basically. So when David visited her, he sat with her for about a half an hour, and she just rubbed his hand and said, the Rabbi came to see me. He came home, and he just looked at me, and he said, you know, we can't leave her there. And I went, yeah. And he said, we have to bring her to our house. And it was like an earthquake all through me that said, yes, of course. This isn't the thing that you would think of. You know, we had two teenagers in the home. We were very busy and didn't have a lot of space. But it was like, yes, that's the answer. So within 2 weeks, we had airlifted her from the nursing home and convinced all the relatives, which in a Jewish family is not an easy thing because everybody had an opinion, which was, no, you can't do this. But eventually it happened because it was supposed to happen, I think.
I'm glad you did the dialect because it's actually well written all through the book, the way she speaks. So tell us this. I want to call her something other than Bubby in this hour. Uh-huh. Lena.
Yeah.
And her last name?
Cantor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kanter.
And what was her history? Where did the accent come from?
Well, she was born in the 1890s in Russia. And I think if you find a lot of Jewish people here, what we call Ashkenazic Jews, are from Europe, Eastern Europe, and a lot of them from Russia, Poland, or Germany. And she was born in Russia and came to the United States when she was 12 in about 1905. So that's where. But of course, her first language was Yiddish. So which that generation, that was the first language for Jews. And second language, Russian. And third language, English, which she learned when she got here.
That's amazing that she got to be 101 living in her own home.
I know. And she did not want to leave that home.
So when you say she was put in the nursing home against her will, it was just the fact that she just didn't want to come out of her own living situation.
She fell. She didn't even break a hip, actually. She just got bruised and disoriented, ended up in a hospital. And then my Aunt Minnie, the 85-year-old, said, you know, we can't take care of her. You know, she was having a few hours of help coming in today. She said, she's going to keep falling. She can't live alone anymore. She can't live alone anymore. And everybody was echoing that. And despite protests from me and my sisters who thought that wasn't a great idea, we thought she should get full-time care at home where she wanted to be. But, you know, our system is set up so that the cost of that is astronomical and not covered by Medicare or any of the other social services. So that's where she ended up, was in this. It was actually a retirement home that did not have the capability to really take care of her as she was getting more and more frail.
The David, your husband, I gather, is not very fond of hospitals or similar places. How about you?
Well, he wasn't then. He's gotten used to it. That was the first year he had just become a rabbi, and that was part of his job, was to do a lot of hospital visiting, which really made him, he didn't like it. But he's gotten more used to it now. I'm fine with it. I actually worked in nursing homes while I was going to school to become a teacher in the 70s. I worked in nursing homes and then hospitals, and so I'm good with it.
Is there any embellishment in here, particularly on the story of the attendant changing Bubby when you went to go see her? This mm-hmm. woman just walks in the room and basically strips her off in front of people sitting there.
Yeah. I wish I could say that there was embellishment. As a storyteller and a writer, I know that the truth, your memories are always filtered through your emotional sense of what was going on. But that having been said, that is how I remember it. She, as I said, was a retirement home, so she didn't have, you know, really good care. So my aunt had hired someone as she deteriorated who was her personal attendant. And so when we came and found her lying in the bed in such bad condition, we called the personal attendant in, and she was very impersonal, very businesslike, pulled off the sheets, pulled off her clothes, and it was, you know, humiliating is really the word I would use. Yeah.
And by that point, had the decision already been made to take her back to your place?
No, that was the last time that I visited her. And then mm-hmm. David visited her a couple months later and said, you know, we have to bring her home.
So how long altogether was she in this retirement home in L.A.?
A year and a half.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
And how far had she slid in your perception?
A lot. The first time that I visited her, my sister and I visited, and she was alert. She could talk about what was going on. She was up. She was ambulatory. You know, we said, how is it here? Well, I don't know. Do you want to stay here? Well, I don't know. You know, she was just, and we took a walk in the hall, and she'd point to all the people and say, these are the old folks. And they would point to her and say, Mrs. Cantor is 103, you know.
She was a bit of a celebrity.
She was. And but then the second time I visited, which was a year later, she had slipped to where she was very disoriented. She was lying in bed in very bad condition, and it was like a different person.
Much more to talk about with Deborah Gordon Zaslow about her memoir, Bringing Bubby Home, a memoir of letting go through love and death. Her 103-year-old grandmother in the family home in Oregon. Back to talk about more of the story and to take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to visit. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Deborah Gordon Zaslow, memoirist, memoir writing teacher, storyteller, and so much more, and the author of her own book. It's called Bringing Bubby Home, a memoir of letting go through love and death, about Deborah Gordon Zaslow's family taking in Deborah's 103-year-old grandmother, taking her out of the home in L.A. and actually bringing her to a real home here in Oregon. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the story, and maybe there's one you can compare it with in your own life. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We've hinted at this briefly thus far, that you had at the time a 14-year-old daughter and a 12-year-old mm-hmm. son.
Yeah.
Also living at home with you and your husband, David. And we're talking about, let's bring Bubby home with us at age 103 and set her up essentially for the last, you didn't really know at that point, but probably a few months of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And how did the kids react?
Not very well, actually. And had it been, I think, a few years earlier, it would have been a different story, because they were always very kind to her when we visited her and so on, and pretty doting to her. But at 14, my daughter had just started high school and my son had just started middle school, and they were very involved with their own activities and being teenagers, which sometimes, as you know, yes. involves resisting whatever mom decides to do. So they were quite skeptical about it. Even my daughter, who one of her, what she would do every weekend is she would go to Linda Vista Nursing Home and bring soup and bring the dog. And she loved visiting old people, but it was more important to her at the time to say, I'm not going to do what you want to do. So she was like, why are you bringing her here? You'll be overwhelmed, which was true. And when I would say to her, can't you spend more time with Bubby? She'd say, you know, instead of going to the nursing home, she'd say, I'm not going to abandon my friends at the nursing home just because you decide to. That was the beginning. But you know what? She totally softened up after, you know, a few weeks or a month. She was down there visiting with Bubby a lot. Now, my 12-year-old son was a little bit of another story because I think he was actually a little frightened by her. And, you know, at 103, she had really deteriorated into what I called the quintessential crone. I mean, her teeth were missing. Her eyes were sunken. She had hands that were like claws. And, you know, there's a scene where she says to Ari, have it a nice kiss, honey. And I could see, you know, he was so
which he, scares the hell out of 12-year-old
exactly,
boys, I know.
Exactly. And so he wasn't as eager to visit as Rachel was.
Your storytelling specializes in folk tales of strong women. Now,
yeah.
Once you had Bubby in the house and everything was getting going, how strong did you feel?
Not very strong at all. And really, I felt like I was in the middle of a maelstrom. I mean, I just walked into it with a big wave of yes, but the first month was really crazy getting her oriented, and then we had round-the-clock caregivers, but we had hired them on the basis of being really kind people, not so much their skill, and I wanted to be there to help her get oriented. So I was training caregivers and orienting them and my grandma and I was teaching storytelling at the middle school in those days and trying to parent and so on. So it was pretty crazy for the first month or so.
There was a fair amount of caregiver churn, I gather, that you went through a few people at the beginning.
We did. Yes, exactly. A couple of them fell by the wayside and just couldn't handle the work. Yeah.
Let's talk about the process in case anybody's thinking about doing this for their own elderly relatives. I mean, there are a bunch of things to think about. You had to do some physical changes, certainly in your home, to make room for Bubby to have a bedroom in the basement of your home. But then there's you know, thinking about accoutrements for her medical care. There's paperwork. There's paying people. I mean, it just sounds like there's a mountain of work here before she ever comes in the door.
That's true. The first month was really getting that all set up, meaning transferring whatever Medicare supplements she was getting to us, hiring the caregivers, equipping the room with, you know, bathroom rails and wheelchair doors. She was able to get up with a walker, but a lot of times she would sit in a wheelchair, and that was easier for her. So we had to do a lot of that. And just even thinking about getting her the kind of food that she would want to eat and the right kind of blankets and a bed with bed rails and et cetera, it was like equipping a mini nursing home. We wanted to have round-the-clock caregivers because we were working and so on, and also so that at night, you know, she would have someone there in case she needed anyone to help her get up or whatever she needed.
Deborah Gordon Zaslow is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her memoir of bringing her 103-year-old grandmother to her house is called Bringing Bubby Home. Walk us back in time just a bit to Lena Cantor before she became this 103-year-old Bubby. I mean, it sounds like she was fun to visit, loving, somewhat stern as well, though. I mean, can you kind of weed that out?
I wouldn't say she was fun to visit or loving. She, you know, as I said, she grew up in the 1890s in Russia, and she was what we would today call an abused child. Or as she, you know, put it, my mother, honey, she didn't tell me what to do. She just beat, beat, beat. And I grew up listening to stories of my grandmother being beaten by her mother and abused. And she had really evolved into what I would call a tough survivor. And whenever I give readings and talk about my grandmother, a lot of times I see everyone's head nodding because a lot of people had the same grandma, an immigrant grandmother or great-grandmother, who had a very tough life. And she didn't allow a lot of sweetness in her life. So although I'd say she was a basically loving person like we all were, that was really covered up by this very sour, negative personality. So, you know, if I had a cold, she'd say, "Oi, honey, I hope you get better." But as if I had leukemia, you know. you know, and really, she wasn't that pleasant a person. So that was part of why it was really a little bit scary for me to bring her into my house, because I was bringing in, I felt like I was bringing in a lot of the family history and the family toxins, and somebody who could at the end become more negative, belligerent, hard to deal with.
Family baggage, in essence, with
exactly.
This person.
Yeah. So the second part, I mean, of the book, the first part of all from the narrative from the journal I kept, but the second part was really mixing in the family stories from when she was little, when I was little, and so on, going back and kind of dealing with that family history.
So. Tell us a bit about your grandfather when he was still alive, Lena's husband. What was he like?
He was worse than her. He was, and nobody liked him. He, you know, they got married, and this is part of what we go back to. She married when she was like, I think, 17 in 1910, really to get out of the house. And he drank a lot. He was not an attentive husband, and they bickered constantly. So that's what I grew up with. If I went to my grandparents' house, was hearing them bicker, and he was not a nice man.
It sounds like holidays and visits then were a bit like, oh boy, here we go. We gotta go see Bubby.
Well, we used to go quite frequently because I grew up in the Valley, and they lived in the Valley then too. So we'd go, you know, at least every week or two, and it wasn't the most fun.
Your mother, as we understand, you mentioned that Bubby outlived three of her five kids.
That's right.
Okay, that your mother died very young, 52, while you were at college. Did this factor a bit in you feeling like you needed to take care of Bubby in her final days?
Yeah, and I don't think I was really aware of it when I actually brought Bubby to my house. But my mother had died when I was 23, and I was here at SOU, and she had pancreatic cancer, which was very quick. So I went back to help take care of her. She wanted to die at home as well and help my dad take care of her and so on. And I was there for a month. And then I came back to kind of take a breath here. And that's when she died. And I think there was a part of me that always felt like I wasn't there for her. I was 23, but when she died. And I think that part of me was doing something for myself to heal that, and also something for her by taking her mother in. There were a lot of subliminal factors at work there.
Deborah Gordon Zaslow is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Bringing Bubby Home, a memoir of letting go through love and death, about taking in her 103-year-old grandmother for the final months of her life. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments about Deborah's experience, or perhaps some things you want to relate about your own in a similar situation. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Part two of the book is called Tornado Touches Down. It really felt like that, didn't it?
Yeah, that was when she arrived, and all of the chaos that I mentioned was just crazy.
Even before she got in the door, though, you had kind of mentally laid out, and probably in your journal as well, best and worst case scenarios for her time with you. Give us a little flavor of each.
Yeah. Well, you know, while I was journaling, I was in pretty... I was in crazy fear mode of what was coming to my house and so on. So I sometimes resorted to humor. So that was part of it, was, you know, best case scenario, you know, was that she would settle in and that the kids would adjust to her and everybody would be happy and we would emerge from this glowing and a happier, even more fulfilled family. And of course, the worst case scenario was she would live forever and everybody at home would be miserable and, you know, we couldn't take care of her and all of the family toxins would be stirred up and, you know, and David would leave home and the kids would grow up juvenile delinquents because I couldn't pay attention to them. So that was just a little humorous interlude. And somewhere in the middle was the reality.
How soon did it really begin to? It sounds like it didn't take very long at all for you to you know, this vision of hands to head, like, oh my God, what have I done?
Yeah, I said it started with a wave of yes, and that decision really came from the gut, from the heart, and then when my rational mind reemerged, I thought, what am I doing? I I get overwhelmed easily. So I'm actually a person with ADD. So that means that if I'm dealing with a lot of things, I'm easily addled. So I thought, how am I going to handle this with teaching and with parenting and so on? And it was true. It was very difficult. But once I had made the decision, the wheels were in motion. So it happened.
All right. So you got down to L.A., you take her out of the nursing home, get her on a plane back to Oregon, mm-hmm. and get her settled in. I mean, how much was she aware of what was going on?
More than I would have thought, because she had deteriorated so much. And once she got to our house, her mind began to come back when she was settled in with more comfort, attention, and love, and so on. But I was surprised how much she was aware of. Just getting her on the plane was crazy, getting her out of the nursing home. She woke up in the middle of the night. Why did they take me to Debbie's? Why did they take me to Debbie's? Even though she had sort of agreed to it in the nursing home, but she didn't remember that. And, so she was aware of a lot. And it took, the first few days of me just sitting with her and saying, the kids want you to be here, which wasn't exactly true. We want you. Looking around, pointing out the window, there's a tree, there's a car, we're here, we're upstairs, and this is so-and-so, and, just orienting her and holding her hand. And it was pretty quick that she began to see that she was getting a lot more love. So she was aware of that. And she certainly knew who I was right through to the day she died, even when she was almost comatose.
And still relatively sharp, as you'd pointed out. I mean, this is a person who could carry on a conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Once you got her in an environment where she could be engaged with again, because it sounds like she wasn't getting anything in that home.
Exactly.
That she was able to kind of, the synapses began firing again.
Exactly. Yeah. And we had a lot of amazingly deep conversations towards the end. I said that she... the hidden jewel in the experience was that she, at 103, had pretty much outlived her personality. So that negative, that crusty covering of negativity kind of slipped off. And we would sit. We'd tip our foreheads together. David called it mind meld. And, just rub hands. And we would just talk about this or that. None of it was what was on my agenda. It was all about learning to feel where she was at and talk with her, whether that was about the past, which she did confuse with the present, or whatever she was feeling at the moment. Sometimes it was talking about God. It was completely different than any of the conversations we'd had in our life. And I think this is true of that time when, just before death, if somebody has a little period where they are dying and you're aware of it, it's really fertile ground for a deeper conversation.
Deborah Gordon Zaslow, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Bringing Bubby Home, A Memoir of Letting Go Through Love and Death. So your 103-year-old grandmother's in your house. Given the some sense of avoidance that you grew up with, I mean, how well did you really know her? Had you gotten to really know her adult to adult at any point in your life before you brought her to your home?
Absolutely. I mean, I visited her even when I lived in Oregon and so on. And as I said, she was very alert till she was 101, and she couldn't wait for someone to come over so she could feed them. Though one of the humorous things in the book is that most people's grandmothers, they have wonderful memories of their cooking. My grandmother was our worst cook in the world. But we had known each other quite well. And as I said, I grew up living nearby and so on. So yes, we were adult to adult. But a lot of our conversations before this time were very negative, mm-hmm.
That's a really interesting concept, though, outliving her personality. I mean, we hear about people whose bodies have outlived their minds all the time. But, but this sense of still being able to carry on a conversation and having gotten past the personality that put this layer of
crustiness over. She couldn't remember who she was angry with. And, I realize this doesn't happen with all people who are dying or people who are really old, that sometimes it's just the opposite. Sometimes people's traits kind of solidify or increase, especially if they're anxious or fearful or negative. They tighten up. But I don't know if it was just being there at the very last moment when she couldn't hold on to that, or if it was because she was surrounded by good caregivers and was relaxed because I was there. I don't know. But she let go. And, you know, even when I tried to, I had thought, well, maybe we can try to talk about her mother and maybe she'll forgive her mother before she dies. That was my sort of pop psychology agenda. And of course, she had no such agenda. She was, she said things that really surprised me when we talk about her mother. She said, she was a fine woman. I said, what about like when she would hit you or when she left you when you were 6 years old with your infant brother? What are you talking about, honey? She really forgot. And she was very present in the moment and quite pleasant to be with. The caregivers couldn't believe that she had been a negative person.
Really? And how did you and the caregivers divide up the care? I mean, how long was anybody else from outside the house in there with her?
Well, there was a main caregiver, and I did change the caregiver's name, so her name is Marilyn in the book. And she was there pretty much 5 days a week. And then there was a weekend caregiver who came. And then there was another one in the middle of the week that gave Marilyn a day break in the middle. And they were on, you know, 24-hour shifts. Yeah.
So really comprehensive. You had to set up schedules and all that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. Schedules and bookkeeping and payments and way beyond my pay grade. But that's what it was.
All right. We'll get back to the logistics and get back to some of the emotional aspects, too, of having your 103-year-old grandmother in your home with you, which was the experience that Deborah Gordon Zaslow and her family experienced. Her book is Bringing Bubby Home, a memoir of letting go through love and death. We'll take a short break and return to the Jefferson Exchange. Got a phone call waiting. We'll take more phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, our final segment today on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Deborah Zaslow. Deborah Gordon Zaslow is a storyteller and an author and a teacher, and she has written a book about the experience of bringing her 103-year-old grandmother home to live with her and her family for her final months. The book is called Bringing Bubby Home, a memoir of letting go through love and death. Maybe these experiences you've had in your own life, or maybe you just want to ask some questions about Deborah's experiences. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 around the listening area. 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. The descriptions of getting ready to have a person in your home, the comparisons are pretty easy to make, and you make them for us anyway, about getting ready for a first child to come home too. and ultimately, how did the feelings after a few days compare with having Rachel home for mm-hmm. the first few days?
Well, what's interesting is that you go into another world. You know, when you first have a baby, it's full of all kinds of new experiences, and you're really sheltered from the outside world, which is, with a new baby, actually kind of a wonderful thing. Some people can complain about the isolation after you know, they're busy with the baby all the time. But with my grandmother, with a bubby, you know, you're also getting ready all kinds of special equipment and food and so on. But the isolation didn't stop through the whole 5 months she was with us. And I think it might be different now, but at least then, I mean, I was saying that now a lot of my friends are bringing their parents home and dealing with death. But then it felt like a very isolated world. A lot of people who were friends didn't want to visit. It was like there was something sort of contagious that, you know, that we had in our basement, and people wanted to avoid it. She was very old and a little scary looking, but that made it very isolating, because just like with a new baby, I didn't get much sleep. I was, you know, really consumed with what I was doing, and then I'd go out into the outside world and it felt very foreign. You know, like I was an outsider. Nobody really understood the world that I had suddenly been thrown into.
The two halves of your life didn't match up.
No, They really didn't. I'd go out to the, I was teaching storytelling at the middle school and so on. I'd go out there and that was one world, and then I'd come back home and it was the world of sort of death and all of the, of what was going on at home.
Let's take a call. We have Valentine and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Deborah Gordon Zaslow.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Hi, Debbie.
Hi.
I just wanted to say mazel tov on the publication of the book, and thank you for your wonderful descriptions of what you went through, which I'm sure is just a tiny bit of what effort that you put out. It sounds absolutely extraordinary what you were saying. I was reminded of my mother-in-law, who we found was in a hospital in New York and was not being taken care of. We used to visit her in Brooklyn. So we put her on a plane, and she sort of grudgingly agreed to come down to Maryland where we lived. And she was in the wonderful Hebrew home there for the last 2 months of her life. And my husband and I were able to go and visit her every day and start to talk and just try to find out something about who she was as a person, where she grew up in Poland, what kind of life she had. And it was really a wonderful experience for me because I was never able to be with either of my parents at the end, and I was with my mother-in-law. So thank you so much for what you're bringing us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And it sounds like there's a lot of parallels in that story in terms of bringing in not just the person, but their history and stories, and you're kind of bringing home the ancestors. I know with you, you said it was a nursing home nearby, but you got to know her in that later phase of her life, which is really a wonderful experience.
You and David, your husband, had in fact had done some of the family history stuff with a video camera a few years before, hadn't you?
We did. When my grandma was 95, we had gone over to her house in North Hollywood, and it was the days of the very first video cameras, right? So we turned it on, and I said, Grandma, you know, I want you to talk about your life. She said, my life? What about my life? What do you want to know? Well, we couldn't get her to stop. She talked for 2 hours.
And you had a tape, probably.
We did have a videotape, but this is ironic, but afterwards, one of the wonderful men who had been visiting her, there were a few people who visited her regularly, my friend Steve, and Bubby loved him because she thought it was her grandson, Tommy, and because they look alike. And anyway, he borrowed that videotape afterwards, and he accidentally taped over it.
Oh,
so we
no.
only have the first 5 minutes of it. However, my cousin Tommy, the one, did have an audio tape because he had interviewed her as well. So he sent me the audio tape so that I could get the stories in her vernacular and so on for the book.
It's really amazing life she lived.
It was. An amazing tenacity and strength that she really had to live through the life that she did with her mother, with the abuse, and then moving to a totally strange country at 12 years old, going to work in a factory, getting married when she was 17. She had her first child on her 18th birthday, had 5 kids, worked very hard. Yeah.
Did she confuse you with your mother toward the end?
Well, not towards the end, but in the beginning, mm-hmm. she did. And there's a scene, I think it's on the first day, where it was always a kind of an anchor for her to look at pictures. So on the first day, I pulled out her photo albums and we're looking, and she's looking at her children and a picture of her when she was young. And she's going, Minnie, Saul, Daryl, Bernice. And then she'd look at me and say, Debbie, instead of my mother, Bernice.
Right.
And I said, no, that's Bernice. And she'd do it again, and Debbie. It was because I knew it was because she saw me there, but that was the first time I had a really eerie feeling that I was doing something for my mother that, you know, that she couldn't do. And towards the end, she would say to me, she would look at me and she'd say, you're Bubby. You're Bubby. Hello, Bubby. And I'd say, no, I'm Debbie. You're Bubby. And so we would laugh and we would, but there was this, it was funny because there really was this sort of interchange, I would say, of our, we were operating on a pretty deep soul level. Everything else kind of dropped away. So who was who, you know, at
right.
that last
stage? Did it really matter at that point?
Yeah.
Let's take another call. We have Julie and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Deborah Gordon Zaslow, the author of Bringing Bubby Home.
Hello. Hi. Thank you so much. This is a beautiful thing that you have opened up for both elders and families of elders. And it just seems like you've really mapped it really well, that so that it will encourage people to actually even look forward to the experience instead of being so afraid. So, you know, the fact that, a person can relax and feel safe, an elder, and feel like they can talk about their lives wherever their consciousness is really interesting to find out, well, where do you really go when you start to go? And so, you know, it's a whole other expanded dimension for everyone to just keep embracing love as we go through it together instead of just sticking somebody somewhere where obviously the caregivers don't care. You know, you described that earlier. I've gone through this with my mom too. So, but anyway, thank you for the book and the mapping and the conscientious commitment.
Thank you.
All right, Julie, thanks for that. Appreciate it. We have an email here from John in Ashland. He says, my grandmother's story is very similar to Deborah's. My grandmother here in Ashland lived to be 100 and outlived two of her three kids, including my mother, who also died of cancer. In taking care of both my mom and grandmother, one rarely discussed factor I feel made a big difference was the hourly rate I paid their caregivers. You simply cannot expect to find good, well-trained caregivers for minimum wage. I paid about 50% higher than the prevailing wages I was seeing in the Valley for caregivers, and after I did this, I had much better success with them. Thanks, John and Ashland.
That's an interesting point. You know, caregivers, as are, you know, teachers and so on, often this are very underpaid. And because of that, I mean, it is difficult to find the right people. And we couldn't pay higher. I think that's a great idea to pay higher if you can, because it wasn't covered by Medicare. But we were able to kind of weed out those who couldn't handle it and found some wonderful people. But, you know, I tried not to whitewash the experience of, because if you're bringing someone into your home, you're also bringing in the caregivers, as we were, and that's living with three other people. And I wanted to, you know, I didn't want to make it sound like, oh, this is very easy. Not every death belongs at home, and not everybody could do that. Just like the other caller said, that she brought her mother-in-law to a nursing home that was close to her home so she could visit but not have to deal with all of those aspects. And some nursing homes are actually very good, especially if you're close enough to be able to visit and to monitor it. But dealing with all of the, you know, there were a lot of conflicts with the caregivers. And although the main caregiver was, all of the caregivers were wonderful to Bubby, but I had conflicts with some of them because the main caregiver, unfortunately, she was overworked and towards the end was getting really tired, and I couldn't get somebody to fill in for her, and she was rightfully upset, and yet I was so stressed that it was difficult to deal with. And I think I dealt with that honestly in the book, that that's something, you know, that's difficult to deal with.
You're pretty clear about that. You know, you're entering the room and the person turns the other way and clearly they're frustrated with you.
Yeah.
Couldn't give them a day off, that kind of thing.
Right.
The care of Bubby, of Lena Cantor, your grandmother, did she understand that her death was imminent? I mean, we haven't talked about the fact she had a tumor growing up.
Well, she did and she didn't. So, you know, that tumor had been discussed, you know, a year or so before, but she had forgotten about it. And there was a point at which I decided that we needed to bring it up to make sense of the pain that was growing in her chest. So I sat her down and talked about it. And the interesting thing was that she kind of went back and forth in time. So she said, you know, she said, I got bad news today, bad news. You know, you'd think at 103 of a tumor, it's sort of, you know, another day. But she said, you know, somebody has to tell my parents. She wanted to tell, you know, she's, or the family has to know. But she meant her parents. So she had forgotten, of course, that her parents had died 50 years ago. So it's like it took her back to, why, I have cancer. And not in the mode of, I'm 103. Oh, my goodness, I've lived so long. And when we tell her she was 103, she'd say, nah, not me. I can't be so old. So, and on and off, she understood about the tumor and the pain. But you know, that was always a little bit in and out. She wasn't quite sure what was causing her pain. And any of the pain medications that we, most of them were not effective because they made her a little bit crazy. So we had to try to really balance things out so that she felt more comfortable, but she wasn't agitated from the medication.
We've talked a bit about the support you got from within the immediate family. I mean, you had your husband, David, and your two kids, Rachel and Ari, at home at the time, both in their teens, which is not a great time to expect kids to be around
call it
the
support,
house.
Yeah. Right.
And it's clear that, I mean, you felt some rage in here, that and your friends were dragging you out of the house and saying, mm-hmm. come on, spend some time with us. You don't have to be at home all the time.
Mm-hmm.
How did that ultimately work out? I mean, because try not to read the back part of the book and give things away. did things improve over time?
They did. I was furious at my poor husband, David, because I felt like it was his idea to bring her. And then I had some illusion that he would be spending a lot of time with her. Well, he was very busy. It was his first year as a congregational rabbi, and he's always busy. So I was down there all the time. My kids were busy with their own lives, and so it was very isolating. And David didn't take a lot of time to visit her. So I was, at first, I felt really upset with him, and I felt very abandoned. Part of the arc of the story, though, is that during this time, and certainly during the time of writing it, I went over, I revisited a lot of the family history. And then the part of the arc of the story is that I realized that it wasn't David who abandoned me, that my feelings of abandonment were sort of living inside of me because of the family history, and partly because of Bubby's history of abuse and so on, things that had trickled through the generation. And I realized that he was who he was, and he was doing the best he could. And we definitely come to a peace with that in the book.
I know, having talked to people who work in hospice, they talk about the possibility of death being a beautiful thing. Did it get to that point for you?
Yeah, I think with her it did. And again, that doesn't happen with every death. And, you know, I had illusions of that she would, you know, I would be there at the moment of her death. But she was with one of the caregivers then, and it was in the middle of the night. A lot, as I said, that crusty covering of negativity had slipped away. She was very comfortable. She had come to love all of the caregivers. And it was a very idyllic death in the end.
It's an amazing story and well told. Bringing Bubby Home, a memoir of letting go through love and death. Deborah Gordon Zaslow wrote it. She's been our guest. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And thanks for the calls as well. That'll do it for today's Exchange. The Exchange is produced by Charlotte Dern of JPR News. Check us out on Facebook and at jeffexchange.org. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again next time and have a great day.